Diana Wiley, your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. I have a wonderful guest, as I often do, but Linda DeVillers, Dr. Linda DeVillers, has been my guest a number of times over the years, going back, probably 8 years. We've been friends for over 30 years, Dr. Linda, haven't we? Hello.
Yes, I'm here and eager to talk.
Good. Linda DeVillers is the author of Love Skills in its sixth edition, fully revised sixth edition. Wonderful book. The subtitle is A Fun, Upbeat Guide to Sexful Relationships. And her other book is wonderful, too. Simple, Sexy Food, 101 Tasty Aphrodisiac Recipes, and Sensual Tips to Stir Your Libido and Feed Your Love. We've talked about both of her books on past shows on Love, Lust, and Laughter. And today we're going to focus on ending a relationship in later years. This is happening more and more. There's even a term for it called gray divorce. Dr. Linda, you and I have both seen older couples who end their relationships in their later years. And so we're going to talk about this because it's timely and maybe isn't discussed quite enough. What do you think about that?
Yes, I think that's quite true. And, you know, it's come up actually as part of the fallout of COVID as well.
Yes, yes, that is true. People that, well, you know, my book, Love in the Time of Corona, a Sex Therapist's Advice for Couples in Quarantine, was meant to prevent people that were stuck together, not sticking together.
Right.
Yes, I think some people got so sick of each other in their quarantine. What have you noticed about this particular dynamic?
Well, I have seen it in my practice in general that more and more couples are. In fact, I'm thinking back to a couple where, they were in their 60s, and in that case, the man was prepared to leave and. And the wife is saying, but what do you mean after all of these years? And he says, I just want a new life. That was some time ago. And more recently, I've been working with a couple where it's the other way around. It's the woman who wishes to end the relationship.
Yes. And, if we go back to a particularly famous example, Al and Tipper Gore, remember our former vice president with Bill Clinton?
Yeah.
Their decision to separate, this was in 2010, so 11 years ago, after 40 years of marriage, came as a surprise to a number of people. You know, they were very much a public couple. But it turns out that breakups among long married couples are actually, or even long not married, but together
couples, right.
Thank you for the word, yes, the description, are actually pretty common. And a quarter of all recent divorces involve people who'd been married for two decades or more, according to one study. Two decades or more. And what they say is that they just simply grew apart. And another real common relationship is common reason is boredom.
Exactly.
Research show that. Boredom, it seems sort of innocuous, but it does exist. Have you seen that in your practice,
well,
the couples that are just simply bored with each other?
For example, the couple I'm still seeing about this, what the woman has said is, I think this is rather common in some relationships, that the man has a certain repertoire of stories that he likes to tell. And the wife has over the years more or less indulged this, but at this moment, every single story that's told, she's probably heard it 50 times. And his habit of telling the tale, as it were, has become much more a significant part of their socialization with other people. Her comment was, I'm either bored or embarrassed.
Bored or embarrassed. Because maybe her older husband is also, there might even be some cognitive decline, and maybe he goes on and on and on. And that can be embarrassing.
Yes, I think that's very accurate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a gray divorce is typically harder on the woman than on the man, because usually the woman is not as financially secure or doesn't have the independence or the salary or the money that her husband
has. Or the pension or whatever, right.
So that's that, but it can be reversed too.
You know, I wanted to bring up, and I'm sorry, but I think he is over 60 now. I'm thinking about, it's been all over the news, Bill and Melinda Gates.
And he is over 60.
That's more of a 27-year relationship, but isn't he in his 60s now? Is that correct?
Yes, he is. Yes, he is. And I think she's like 57. She's close.
Right. Anyway, that to me has been an intriguing example. You know, that particularly since they are such a high profile couple, and they're obviously they're so intertwined. And of course, between the lines, there's some sort of raunchy stuff that I've read. But above and beyond that, my sense is that this is a woman who has felt she's been under his shadow for quite some time. And is ready to enough. I want to do the things that I want to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a good example of a couple. And in that case, I believe it's infidelity has been part of the picture. At least that's what's insinuated.
Okay. I wasn't certain
and research does show that nearly a quarter of all couples engage in infidelity at one point or another. So we don't know what was going on with Bill and Melinda, just as another famous couple from some years ago, I think 2011, was Arnold Schwarzenegger and Maria Shriver. And of course, know that was infidelity.
Right.
I read this somewhere that an article called Relationship Boredom, and the author said, thanks to Arnold and Maria, couples have once again been reminded that relationships are very fragile. There are threats from everywhere, from little things like flirty relationships to biggies like infidelity and supersized betrayals. Arnold style. So these are complicated. These are complicated situations. And it's painful. It's painful for everybody concerned, as all divorces are.
You know, I want to bring up another thing that we've covered boredom. The other intriguing thing that I see sort of in the context of where I'm living now is that some older couples, it turns out you have one person who's rather adventurous and really wants to travel. And this is pre-COVID, and the other person says, no, I'm afraid of planes, or I don't want to travel. And I think that creates a huge rift as well.
I agree with you. And of course, there may be some health complications. For the person who doesn't want to travel because maybe they don't have the mobility they used to have or something like that.
Yeah, that's true. And obviously, we could say, I mean, we both know people who do manage to independently travel. You know, you go do your travel thing and I'll stay home, that aren't torn asunder, as it were, as a result of that. But I just know that I've seen it play more than one way.
Absolutely. And what helps is if somebody comes out of a family with secure attachment. I really look at lots of couples' relationships through the lens of attachment theory. And, of course, Helen Fisher, she studied romantic rejection. She was at Rutgers University, and she had access to a functional MRI, which I'm sure you know about.
Of course.
And she discovered, this is so interesting, she discovered that thinking about one's beloved activates the same parts of the brain associated with addiction, motivation, and reward. So her work suggests that love itself is addictive, and the rejection prompts a kind of neurochemical withdrawal, and it's characterized by heightened anxiety and obsession. So yeah. We've got our brains going to town here, and of course the attachment theory too. Do you use attachment theory sometimes in your work?
Yes, sometimes I do. That is absolutely. Mm-hmm. Or I may not always call it that, but I'm always very interested in knowing. So, what was life like when you were growing up, and was it a stable family? And did you get? You know, were you acknowledged? Were you supported, et cetera?
Yeah. Researchers in the field of attachment theory believe how our earliest experiences with parents and caregivers influence the way we respond to breakups. So if caretakers were available and responsive when we needed them, and of course that's predominantly in infancy and early childhood, although the theory holds that close attachment figures are still essential in middle childhood anyway, so they're thought to be more likely to develop secure attachment style in their interpersonal relationships as adults. Because if we have parents like this who were available and responsive, and that's really what we want in an adult relationship too. We want somebody who is available and will be responsive to us. So if we have secure attachment style in our interpersonal relationships as adults, then we're more likely to feel worthy of love, and our partners serve as a secure base in our lives. And the end of a relationship doesn't gravely affect our fundamental sense of ourselves. So that's secure attachment. But
right, and it leads to more optimism about maybe I can move on from this and
absolutely
be successful in a future relationship.
It does. It does indeed. That you have a sense of yourself, and that you will be attracted to somebody else in the future. That because if somebody comes out of insecure attachment, and that's where early caretakers are not consistently available when needed, and sometimes this happens too with parental death, and so. Those with anxious attachment style tend to have more needy behavior in intimate relationships, and of course these people have a much harder time when relationships end.
Exactly, they respond more catastrophically. Yeah.
catastrophically, yes. And, yeah, I think it's very interesting to look at the role of attachment style in breakups. Because sometimes there's a lot of anxiety that comes to the surface with a breakup. Anxiety that's, there can be, I've seen this in clients, a preoccupation with the ex and the loss of the relationship. And there's typically a lot of physical and emotional distress and sometimes dramatic efforts to restore the relationship, and also sometimes angry and vengeful behavior.
Right. And I mean, in the extreme, you know, stalking is possible.
Yes, it is. You know, some of these folks that have this kind of insecure attachment, well, if we look at it from a Freudian point of view, we could say it's largely a translation of infantile strategies for satisfying their needs into adult life.
Right. And it's recapitulating the style. What happened.
Yes.
Childhood.
Mm-hmm. You're cutting off a little bit. Maybe it's where you are.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
But now it sounds okay. It sounds okay now.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was not holding the phone itself, so maybe that was the problem.
Okay. No, it's good now. It's good now.
Okay.
So, what have you noticed in some of your older couples who break off, whether they've been in a committed relationship for a long time or actually married? What else have you noticed with these folks?
Well, I think what I noticed is that, I mean, ideally both people notice this, but I think older couples, as they're entering, you know, the final stages of life, nevertheless put a lot of emphasis on the importance of quality of life. And so they're making this decision, particularly, obviously, the person who wishes to move on, that they will that they wish to maximize the quality of life, and they don't believe that the relationship that maybe was nourishing originally is still serving that purpose. And that's a key aspect of the decision. I think, obviously, they may be thinking that, but what gives them the courage to do this is obviously going to be in part about economic stability and whether they would have that. And also, we know that with aging, how important it is. We know at all stages of life, it's really important to have a friendship network. But at least in my clients that are whether they're thinking of splitting up or not, they have a more solid friendship network, which enables them to be even entertaining the idea that they might leave.
Because they get feedback from their friends,
and that kind of supports them in their
thinking.
Feedback. They have people to bounce off. Depending on the nature of the friendship, I mean, one of the couples I'm thinking of has found that one of her friends is saying, is sort of making the overture, would you like to go here? You know, how about if we go to the movies? You know, and yet they in the past went with their partner. And they're hoping to engage them in activities.
So that they don't feel so isolated and alone, because they may, if the partner has already, or the spouse has already left, or maybe hasn't quite yet left, but it can be a very isolating, depressing situation.
I think that's true for the person that's
really essential.
Being left, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, in the case of men, I mean, we already know that women on average are a little better at establishing close friendships.
Yes, they
are. And that men's friendships more often, you know, are let's watch the football game together, you know, sort of the action stuff. So that whichever person is suffering, women on average are going to have a little better situation in terms of turning to others for emotional support than
the typical. That famous UCLA study, maybe 20 years ago now, that showed that girlfriends tend and befriend. They kind of make a circle around the one who's suffering.
Yes.
And they support her. And men typically just don't have that. When I was still dating Brian, my husband, and getting to know him, one of the things that really impressed me is that he has four male friends. No, maybe he's the fourth. He has three male friends that he's had for 40 years. And three of them live in this area and get together every couple of months. And one lives back east but comes out from time to time. And I thought, you know, isn't that wonderful and these guys get together and they do talk about their feelings and their relationships. They're most unusual, really.
That's very exceptional and wonderful. Yeah.
But that, for me, was a green flag. I thought, oh, that's good. That's good. He's got male friends.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because so many men don't. They, of course, our female and male brains are different. And and we have more estrogen, and which from the beginning makes us more nurturing and caregiving. And testosterone can give us a sense of well-being, but it's also an overload of testosterone can make us aggressive, especially men.
Right.
I think the best example of that is O.J. Simpson. He was a professional football player, overloaded testosterone.
Right.
I mean, there were other things too, but, you know, he committed murder, most people believe.
Right.
And so we've got these different hormones and that affect how we behave, and little girls are often modeling. You know, they have little dolls, and they take care of people and pets and things like that.
Do remember though that some of the research shows, you know, as men and women get over the age of 50, that you tend to see that. I think the ratio of testosterone and estrogen in women alters such that women may have a little bit more testosterone than they had before, and that men do show a reduction of high testosterone levels, say when they're 65, 75, that actually is good. I mean, the two sexes, you know, sort of meet in the middle a little bit more.
Gail,
but I think the friendship thing, though, the problem with the friendship thing is that that's a behavioral pattern, and so it got established when the hormones were definitely different in men and women.
That's true. And Gail Sheehy talks about the crossover effect that occurs for most men and women after the age of 50, where the in Jungian terms, the animus, the male persona comes more to the forefront in a woman, so she's more assertive and taking charge and saying, it worked out really well in the bedroom for lots of couples, saying what she wants and needs. And the man's anima, his female side, comes more to the forefront, and that is his more tender, gentle, sensitive. Oh, let's do foreplay for a long time. It feels so good.
Exactly.
If things work out well, there is this crossover effect that does enhance lots of relationships. But so many older couples experience boredom or embarrassment or something else, and they don't have that crossover effect, or they don't allow it to emerge. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's quite accurate. Yes, I agree with you. Or, you know, I'm trying to think of other things. Maybe we could even think about certain habits that possibly are irritating. You know, on the one hand, older couples who've been with the same person for a long time may sort of gloss over, or they may be more accepting of sort of bad habits. But on the other hand, I think for a different set of couples, they become more irritating, whatever it might be.
The habits,
yeah. On the floor, yeah. That people get a little more sensitive to that, you know.
And especially if they haven't talked about these things. You know, here's a quote from Marilyn Monroe. "My marriage brought me neither happiness nor pain. My husband and I hardly spoke to each other. This wasn't because we were angry. We had nothing to say."
So, is she talking about Arthur Miller? Which one is she talking about?
Well, I don't know, because I don't have a date.
Wow. That's
if it was Arthur Miller, it would be a surprise. Maybe it was Joe DiMaggio.
Who knows?
I'm thinking maybe the baseball player instead of the screenwriter would have nothing to say, but I don't know. I just don't know.
Yeah, you would think Arthur Miller had a voice. But, wow, that's fascinating that she said that. Wow.
I think it is, too. But, you know, I'm quoting, I have another quote here from Woody Allen, and this will help us segue into a conversation about how important it is to talk. But so this is Woody Allen. "A relationship, I think, is like a shark, you know? It has to constantly move forward or it dies." Uh-huh. And I think what we've got on our hands is a dead shark. A dead shark. Yeah.
Right.
A dead shark. Right. Because, and that is that's part of boredom. They're not discovering new things about each other. They're not, of course, that's a big advantage of travel. You do have new experiences.
Exactly.
And things to talk about. And we need that dopamine. Some recent brain studies have shown that if you, even in anticipating something really good and juicy, mm-hmm. and especially hot sex, the anticipation right. of that produces dopamine. You know, before that we thought, maybe it's the actual when you're involved in some novel activity. Mm-hmm. But it's even the anticipation of it produces dopamine, the hormone of arousal. Dopamine is really important.
That's quite true. And along the same lines, I'm recalling an article. I don't recall all the details, but it had to do with whether you imagine that you're taking a brisk walk and mm-hmm. that you will alter your neurotransmitter patterns, imagining that you are engaged in an activity.
Oh, I like that. So
I know. I don't think we should substitute that, but it's still an interesting point.
So it maybe reflects that we move toward what we visualize, the Buddhist idea.
Yes.
So
right.
if we visualize something.
Little implicit motor movements that we're not even aware of that take place when you're imagining, engaging in an activity.
Yeah. We have the breakup, the gray divorce is hard on older people, typically. It's very hard. And you and I, when we had our pre-interview, you mentioned a phrase that I have heard too, and it's that some older guys are simply looking for a nurse with a purse.
And, yeah, right.
Yeah. And a lot of older women, especially healthy older women who still want to travel and maybe even still want to work, if we're lucky enough to have work that's satisfying and we feel like we're making a difference, then isn't that quite wonderful? But a lot of women don't want to be a caregiver to an old sick dude.
And I know that, I mean, this can sound brutal, but for some women, I think they've raised kids and you know, they've certainly been caregivers in that regard and with a spouse, especially if they're cooking and, you know, catering to a man, that say, wait a minute, I've done enough of this. And yes. I'm thinking of this one particular couple where the woman said, you know, so he's basically able-bodied right now. But there are things I really resent, and he's very critical of all sorts of things. And I don't envision myself in 5 years pushing him in a wheelchair. As I say, that's rather brutal, but it was an honest statement on this woman's part that she was thinking long range and very aware that she did not want to be a major caregiver.
Pushing his wheelchair, and especially if he hadn't been nice to her.
Exactly.
And the criticism. Yeah. I have this quote. I love quotes. This one's from Katharine Hepburn, and this fits so well with what we're talking about. If you want to sacrifice the admiration of many men for the criticism of one, go ahead, get married.
Well, that's very good.
And of course, she famously had a long time romance with Spencer Tracy, who was married, and she, I don't think Katharine Hepburn was ever married. So she practiced what she preached.
I don't think so.
Yeah. Well, she was a woman ahead of her time.
Yeah, she was. And I think she was so deeply in love with him that I could be wrong. But my hunch is that once he died, I don't think she got involved in romantic relationships. I mean, I could be maybe I'm wrong, but
right.
That was the sense one had.
Yeah. Yeah. So perhaps we should talk about solutions.
Exactly.
You know, we could call it rejection relief, because a divorce or a breakup of a long-term relationship is major rejection, right? Being dumped can be excruciating, and especially if you're the dumpee. but there is relief, and you and I spoke about exercise off the air, and one of the points that I like to make when I'm working with couples, or sometimes it's a divorced woman or a widowed woman, force yourself to have fun. We're back to dopamine, because this boosts dopamine and serotonin, and that is an antidepressant. And try new things, and you know, it becomes a form of self-soothing. It takes your mind off the relationship that feels that has no longer feels good, but it's you know, the going mood boosters. Exercise is huge, and I know what an avid tennis player you are. You've always believed in exercise. If we go back 40 years, maybe you did some of the original studies on exercise and sex. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yes. And I'll be rather personal here. I had always noticed, in fact, this was more when I was even in my late teens, early 20s, that I happened at the time to be in a family that went on a lot of ski trips. And I was very aware of how my interest, I mean, just literally I was tingling with sort of erotic desire at the end of a day of skiing. And, you know, it was pretty vigorous. And I never shared that with anybody. I just thought I was kind of maybe weird. And then I had an experience during my marriage in the 20s when my former spouse, at the time we were married, and he, I remember it was wintertime, but he went off to a conference or something, and I decided to go swimming in an indoor pool, and I had, doing that, I had exactly the same experience. That, and the true confessions, you know, I was definitely masturbating at the end of this lovely little swim. It was in the evening that I was going. When I went through the UCLA sex therapy training program, and through that program, met a psychiatrist who was looking for a colleague to work with at his clinic, and he was approached by Shape Magazine, and he contacted me and said, "Hey, Shape Magazine wants me to do a survey on the relationship between body image and exercise." And he asked me if I was interested in participating, because I think he honestly thought a woman would maybe have more say about all of this. And I said to him, "Well, I'm sort of interested, but I'm more interested in the connection between sex and exercise." And the two of us designed a questionnaire, and we systematically posed questions, and he agreed. He said, "Look, we're supposed to do it on body image, but let's sneak in some sex questions." So we worked out with regard to desire, arousal, and orgasm. We said, "How long have you been in an exercise program?" And then we said things like, "Since beginning your exercise program, have you noticed any increase in sexual interest, decrease, or no effect?" And we did that for desire. We did that for orgasm and arousal. And curiously, when it was time to publish the results, and because it was in a national magazine, we got over 8,000 responses, which at the time especially was, I mean, that's pretty large number of
that really is 8,000 responses. Yeah. So it obviously hit a chord for a lot of people.
Yeah. And so then we hired somebody to do all the number crunching. And strangely, there was a change of editorship with Shape Magazine, and we were directed, "Please do not include the sex questions, only do the body image answers." So we dutifully wrote the answer. You know, we wrote an article that dealt with body image and exercise, and of course it was a positive effect. But that let me, then the lovely psychiatrist said, "Linda, if you want to run with the rest of the data, just be my guest." And so I decided, and I bet you were there, that we had those data also analyzed, and I presented at the Society for the Scientific Study of Sexuality in San Francisco. And I think we're talking, we're probably talking about give or take 1988, 89 maybe?
Yeah.
And
I think I was favorite, there, and that's, I think I was there.
And I don't know if you've heard this whole detail or not before, but the topic was something like, my paper was titled exercise body, maybe body image, and women's sexuality. And sure enough, so that's the title. I received a phone call the day before I presented, because the program was out. I get a phone call from a staff writer from USA Today who bluntly says to me, I don't know if you've heard all of this, who says,
I don't think so. So tell me.
I was looking over the program of this upcoming work conference. And frankly, most of the papers look really boring, but yours caught my attention.
Yes.
And so she, of course, inquired what were the findings. And with regard to the connection, it had the most significant effect, exercise did, on sexual desire.
Yes. And that was what you found out by accident.
Yeah. And 40% of women said, and what was also very cool, which I forgot to say about the research, was that we had asked, since beginning a program, how are you affected? But I also asked about immediate effects, because remember my lovely ski experience and swimming experience. I said, immediately following exercise, I don't remember if I said 90 minutes, but I knew later from some other data that that was important. I said, immediately following exercise, do you feel more interested, less interested, or no effect? And we also got a significant effect for immediately after exercise. Yes, my desire increases. And it was a smaller number of women who reported that their orgasmic response was better. But that... So that woman from USA Today took my basic numbers, and then I learned a lesson about marketing, I guess. The title that ran in USA Today said, "Working Out Builds Women's Sex Drive." And that was the altered title from my original title. And because it was national, because it involved numbers, the media ran with it, and frankly, I loosely say, the phone didn't stop ringing for a decade. All sorts of magazines, everybody was interested in this. And the good news is that although there are various flaws, it was a questionnaire and a magazine, and only, you know, women who read the magazine even bothered, but there were follow-up studies done on major university campuses that corroborated my basic findings.
Yes, there was a study I'm aware of some of them, yes.
Middle-aged swimmers, and I think it was at Yale, you know, they got a matched sample of people who were swimmers and people who didn't exercise at all. And sure enough, those who were regular swimmers reported a more active sex life. And a similar study was done at the University of California, San Diego, that assigned a group of men to either jog, walk, or do nothing. And they were randomly assigned to three categories. They were told there was a wait list and not everybody could be a part of their program. And they particularly documented that men who ran on a regular basis had higher interest in sexual activity. And I always have to add, that's if you're not compulsive about it. You know, if you get obsessive about exercise, then it's going to boomerang and not be effective. But that's the scoop.
Well, I remember reading about those studies, and I have been a regular swimmer for, I think, 50 years now, and fortunately I have a very good libido, and I think my husband dances for exercise and walks, and
yes,
those are
absolutely
wonderful things to do, walking briskly.
Well, I'm just going to say the dancing, especially if the two of you dance together, that's sort of got an extra perk going on. Yeah,
that's right. It's when you dance together, you're moving together. I sometimes in my couples counseling, if the couple seems really out of sync with each other, really out of rhythm with each other, and if they've never studied ballroom dancing and they're at all inclined to dance together, I suggest they take ballroom dancing lessons.
No, I think that's a great
idea. And they can move together.
Exactly. No.
And so that is so. So let's let's use this, the importance of exercise to successful aging. So yes. That's a good segue back to our topic, and this was a great, because you're known for this. I mean, I always, that's why I could bring it up. I remember reading about this over the years, you writing about sex and exercise and the benefits. But let's talk about ending a relationship in later years. And if obviously if you're in good health and you're dancing and you're exercising and you're playing tennis or you're swimming or whatever you're doing, you're having some fun and you're getting the dopamine and the serotonin and you're trying new things. And I think it helps you with self-soothing, too. So it's a very good thing for successful aging.
And if we're talking about, again, ending a relationship and wanting to move on, the kinds of things we're suggesting are one of the ways, certainly there's more direct ways, of being out and meeting people and interacting.
Yes.
And having the potential of, you know, friend of a friend or directly meeting somebody. These kinds of things are, you know, there's that old classic of follow your interests. And seniors should do that. Follow your interests.
That's right. And there are There are meetup groups that have specialized interests. And then there's online dating. And the statistics are that the largest demographic for online dating are people over 50. That's the largest demographic.
Fascinating. That's great.
Yes, it is. And it's really the best way. When you're older, you're not going to, well, you can, through exercise, you might meet somebody. I think that's a very healthy way. But you're not, but going to a bar, you're not.
Right.
And, of course, with the pandemic, that's cut that down a lot anyway, if not extinguished it. But I think you have a better chance with online dating because the questionnaires and the algorithms, and you already know a fair amount about your prospective date.
Right. And you have to, you know, I was just reading, the Los Angeles Times, which I take, regularly has a column every single Sunday called Modern Love. And, I find it fascinating to read some of the suggestions. I think there was actually a question and answer about this, that you're more successful, I'd be curious about your own experience, if you you don't spend an inordinate amount of time once you've, you know, you want to check somebody out online, that you do some conversation and maybe two or three times, but that you don't go on weeks and weeks texting each other before you meet up.
Absolutely. Texting is not talking.
It made sense to me that.
Yes.
And is that what you used to do?
Yes. I was doing online dating. I was a widow and I waited a couple of years. And then when I was in Los Angeles after moving from Honolulu, I began to do some online dating. Unfortunately, in LA, I mostly encountered pretty narcissistic men. Big surprise. But then when I moved to Seattle, it was entirely different. And that's when I met this incredible man that I had in my life. And that was through Match.com. And I used, we were doing the email exchanges and we decided to meet for the first time. And I said in the email, I'd like to have a telephone conversation with you before we meet. And he said that was unusual. And, of course, in my case, I wanted to tell him that, because I'd not put this in my profile, that I was also a sex therapist. I put down that I was a marriage and family therapist, which I am, and that I'm a gerontologist, right. which I am, but I left out the sex therapy part because I kind of wanted, it was, in a way, it was a litmus test. The man might be intimidated or whatever. So Brian and I had our telephone call before we met, and I said, and I wanted to tell you that I'm also a sex therapist. And his response gave me such a good feeling. He said, oh, that is really wonderful. So he wasn't the least bit intimidated by it. But yes, texting is not talking. And too many people, no matter their age, I think are, especially if they have social anxiety, but they're texting, 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 and they're not talking. And the only way that you can really determine chemistry is to meet up in person and to talk.
Exactly.
So don't.
Exactly.
I think the modern love, that is a good column. It's been around for years, as I remember, because I remember reading it too. That's absolutely true. Too many people are spending way too much time texting, and they don't get a chance to actually meet.
And the point, too, of that article was, which, you know, whether anybody listening or with a client, is that you can suddenly start developing all sorts of fantasies about this person, you know, when you go on too long doing that. And so it's a really big letdown if you meet them and go, oops, you know, not feeling right.
Yeah, that's right. And some people use photographs that are 20 years old, and so they don't even look like they look on the online thing. So all of those things. Well, it's pretty hard to break up a relationship after such a long time, and especially if you're the one who has been rejected. And especially if you feel like your self-worth depends on a relationship.
Right.
And so that person is much more likely to suffer a lot when they feel like the relationship is over.
And that's where I come back to, that's where it's so important to have the support network that one can turn to. And also, I mean, we should obviously, as therapists, be, and it may well be an excellent time to enter therapy if the person has
absolutely
not
it is
so
a great
before.
Time.
Yeah,
I think you know, you've got the post-breakup brain state, and it's for lots of people, it's very unpleasant, but it's a good time, I think, to seek therapy. And and so going back to Helen Fisher, I think her research is just so fascinating because she was able to use to look at people's brains using the functional MRI. But what she found, her research found that after a romantic rejection, people showed increased activity in the forebrain area associated with responding to gains and losses. So, yeah, a reflection of one of the rejected lover's determination to figure out what happened to the relationship. You're already thinking, why did he do this? What did I do wrong? And so you're in this state. You're receptive, so it's a good time to seek therapy, right?
Yeah,
and help have a professional kind of help you work it through, because you know, if no relationship is a failure, if when you break up, you know that you've kept your eyes open and you have learned and improved, so that you can take lessons and go on to the next relationship, which is likelier to be happier and healthier.
Right. Very well said.
Yes. Well, and I think in this process we need to also cultivate self-love. You know, it's hard to do when if a person feels that they've been rejected, But being compassionate and gentle with yourself
exactly.
is really an important to the recovery process, I think. And so that they people. One study actually showed that people bounce back faster when they are kind and forgiving of what they did or did not do in their marriage. Experience emotion without getting stuck in anger and sadness or regret. So you have to be forgiving of yourself and not beat up, because a lot of people are they have very well developed inner critics, don't they? And
they
just will beat up on them. So what did I do? And that's why it's so useful to find the right therapist to help you through the process.
True. And I'd be curious to know, what are your personal beliefs about how one does pick the right therapist?
Oh, well, I think it's different for different people, but certainly a referral can be very strong if somebody you know well has had a good experience with a therapist. I think you've got to shop around because you need to act like a consumer, and that the therapist client needs to be a really good fit. And you can ask you can ask the therapist if they'll give you a 15-minute free consultation on the phone so that you can, or some will even offer half an hour. And to see if you ask them questions about how long they've been in practice, have they dealt with your particular issues before, which you describe, and all of that. Do you think that makes sense?
Yeah, I do. And that was going to be my basic point. I do think it's important to do a little shopping of, say, two or three people that either come through referrals. I increasingly think... you can tell a fair amount about a therapist by their website. And
yes, that's
true. I just think that's interesting. A fair number of therapists put up what they would call their philosophy of therapy, or some people even have little sound clips of themselves, you know, so that you kind of really get the flavor of that person and whether that seems like something that is a good fit for you or not.
You know, I get some people contacting me because they've gone to Psychology Today, and I'm part of their directory. And so they'll send an email, typically. Sometimes they call. And then if they haven't been to my website, I always say, please visit drdianawiley.com and look at the client sessions page. There's a lot of information there. And then on my website, I go over areas that I feel that I often deal with that have to do with sexual behaviors and relationships and so on. So, don't you find too that people, because you have a really good website, it'll be in my show notes, but it's drlinda. DeVillers.com. Linda, DeVillers.com. Yeah.
In fact, I have a brand new couple that I just started with last week, and that's kind of exactly what she said. She had visited my website and said something like, I don't know whether it was I like the way you presented things or the kinds of things you said, but something about my site resonated with her, and that's what led her to call, which is
Isn't
good.
Isn't that great? It's very good. It's very good. You are a wonderful therapist and a wonderful writer and a wonderful aphrodisiac specialist.
I do like that topic. We should revisit that one again in the future.
We will, and I'm going to have you back. That's the music. That means this show is over. I'll be in touch with you, Linda. Thank you so much for being
You're
on the program
very welcome.
Today.
I enjoyed it. All right. Bye-bye.
Well, good. And we'll talk again soon. Bye-bye, everybody.